Okay, welcome everybody. Welcome everybody to the last Torah for Tycoons of this season. We've been running for many years straight here, and I would like to thank Rabbi Zev Baron and the Harry H. Baron Foundation for sponsoring this series once again as we close. And we look forward to everybody coming back September? I believe it's September. Yeah, we're going to take July and August off, as we customarily do. Just three quick programs I wanted to announce before we start today's program. The first is that the Kollel's division for senior citizens, the gold senior division, is, if you don't know about it yet, please speak to Joyce in the back. She runs the division. And there was weekly free lunch and learns for those seniors who would like to participate. If you know somebody, that's a it's a wonderful program. And there's programs throughout the year, throughout the month. There's an interesting presentation that is going to be given. Oh gosh, I don't have my bifocals today. What is it?
June 8th.
Oh gosh, I'm going to have a hard time reading the notes. June 8th. Okay, and that's going to be at the Maisel Museum. That's going to be the story, a simple twist of faith by a local author who describes her own journey from a evangelical Christian to a observant Jew. Fascinating story. I know this woman read the book cover to cover. And then I'm just going to talk about this very briefly. This coming Sunday, there is a fascinating concept that the Kollel is doing. We're going to actually complete one tractate of the Talmud as a community in 1 hour. When you ask me how we're going to do that, so the answer is we're going to split it up. When all the people are participating, we're going to set them up in appropriate pairs that can be able to tackle a page of the Talmud. Each pair is going to get a segment to do. We're going to make a communal completion, a siyum. It's going to take place this Sunday. Please join if you can. And finally, today's program, Torah for Tycoons. Today we are going to discuss concern for a cause, ensuring your philanthropy achieves its goals. The presenter is myself and Bruce Dubowski, who has a very, very interesting background. He's been a lawyer. He was the regional director of the ADL for 9 years and has moved on to a consultancy in philanthropy. And he advises many people, and in addition to writing a syndicated column, which probably many of you have seen, in the Post, obviously, right?
And starts in the Post.
Starts in the Post. And there's no other choice. Starts in the Denver local paper and goes around the country to many papers. Bruce is going to present the dilemma, and then I'm going to address the issues.
Great. Thank you, Rabbi. I was 21, traveling by myself, backpack, a little more hair, camera, in a remote area of Turkey. And I awoke one morning in this little village to the sound of a crowd. I heard laughing, I heard all kinds of noise, and I decided to get dressed and get out of bed and go see what the ruckus was about. And what I came upon that day literally changed my life. Because as I walked into the middle of this little village, I came upon a crowd, a mob of about 100 people standing right in the village square. And the square had steps down to the center, and they were all on the outside. And I came up to the side of this group of people, and I looked in over the crowd down below, and I saw a young man about my age, who was clearly mentally disabled. And the crowd was throwing rocks at him, and throwing sticks at him, and throwing cans at him, and he was bewildered and he couldn't figure out how to even defend himself. And the crowd was roaring with laughter, just undulating with joy at this young man's suffering. And then somebody came up from behind him and put a paper bag over his head and spun him around, and he fell to the ground and he couldn't even figure out how to get up, and the crowd just erupted in laughter. And I stood on the edge of this, on the edge of this mob, and every cell in my body told me to go in there and rescue that young man and defend him and protect him. But I also knew that here I was, a Westerner, a Jew, a hippie. I would have gone into the middle of that crowd, and if they could have done what they were doing to one of their own, I could only have imagined what they would have done to me. So as I stood there, I had to make a choice. Do I go in there and risk my own life, or do I turn my back on that young man? I turned my back on that young man. I walked away. And I left the town. I could hear the roar of the crowd behind me, the laughter continuing, the noise, the sounds. And I said a prayer. I said, "Please, God, please, don't ever make me be a bystander again." And I came back to this country after the rest of this solo journey. And I never told a person that story. I have friends, dear friends in this audience, who have heard me give countless ad nauseum speeches at ADL and other places. I never told the story until a few years ago, when I finally was able to get it out and share it with people in my new line of work as a philanthropic strategist, because I felt it was so important for really several reasons. One, and then we'll get to the topic, I promise, Rabbi. One is that I've learned in my journey that everybody has stories. Everybody has things that have happened to them along their way, especially as young people. Some far more dramatic and more life-threatening than mine. Mine was just a very difficult moral dilemma. But others obviously have fought in wars and have been victims of violence and discrimination and other things. And so it's important to encourage people to identify with and tell their stories. Second of all is that I really truly believe is that that moment was life-changing for me. I think it, at that moment, when I asked God for help and I said, "I don't ever want to be a bystander," I was able to dedicate my life to the work that I have done in all of my work, and that is trying to get involved, trying to come to the aid of others, trying to make a difference. And I really truly believe that that tragedy of that young man was informative in my own journey. And thirdly, and finally, the reason I choose to share the story now is that I deeply believe that at this point in our history as Jews, our history as Coloradans, our history as Americans, that none of us can afford to be a bystander. That all of us have to roll up our sleeves and go in and tackle the problems and take the risks and do the work that's necessary to repair the world, to fulfill our obligation for tikkun olam. And so that's why I practice law. I went to the ADL. My successor, my friend and amazing colleague Scott Levin, is now the leader of ADL. And then about 6 years ago, I started this practice where all we do is help families, businesses, foundations, individuals become more strategic, more thoughtful, more impactful with their philanthropic dollars. How do they have more impact for themselves as donors, for their families, for their businesses, for themselves? That's okay. And then how do they have more impact in the world so they can make more of a difference with their philanthropic investments? And so that's what we do. So the rabbi and I have had a number of really good conversations. He makes me think a little harder, a little deeper about some of the questions that I get a chance to work with people across the country. I have clients from coast to coast and north to south, helping them with their philanthropic investments, their philanthropic strategies. And we came up with four questions that we thought we might be able to get to in a brief session over lunch at the East Side Kosher Deli on June 1st. These are topics that you could spend hours on. Many have written books on. And these are just some of the topics that I deal with clients on a regular basis that we thought would be interesting. So the first question is it better to invest your philanthropic dollars in immediate needs, the pressing need of the moment for a particular person or individual or group, or is it better to invest your dollars in longer-term systemic solutions to avoid those problems from arising in the first place? The second issue is it better to give anonymously, to give without anybody knowing that you're the donor, or is it better to get, seek, and have recognition for your philanthropic contribution? The third is a little bit of an interesting twist, and that is, what if your favorite charity, the charity you love the most, accepts money from other donors who make their money in illegal or immoral ways? Do you have a right as a donor? Do you have an obligation as a donor to go to that nonprofit organization and say you can't accept that dirty money because it's earned unethically, and you can't greenwash it by turning it from bad to good causes? And finally, is just a little practical, little pet peeve of mine that isn't particularly halakhic, but it is, should you donate to charities over the phone or at the front door? And I always like to tell people how to answer that question in one word, but we'll get to that. I'll keep you on the edge of your seat until I tell you what that one word is at the end of the day.
Can't you guess, huh?
So we're going to start by talking about, Rabbi is going to talk a lot about, is it better to invest your dollars in an immediate pressing need or a long-term systemic goal? And before I let him speak, I can't believe I have the nerve to say that. There's a parable that we use a lot in our work, and that is that two men who are walking, and they come to a riverbank, right? And they look into the river, and they see people in there drowning, floating downstream and drowning. And one of the men immediately takes off his shirt and takes off his shoes, and he dives into the river, and he goes to rescue as many of the drowning people as he can. The other man runs upstream, runs along the shore of the banks of the river to figure out, how did they get in the river in the first place? Let's see if we can prevent them from getting in there to begin with. And that's this question about, do you save a drowning person, or do you work to prevent people from drowning in the very first instance? And which one of those has a greater value in the world today? And with that...
Thank you, Bruce.
There you are.
Okay. Excellent. So let's address this first question first, the dilemma between immediate needs and supporting long-term systemic goals. So this world presents us with a constant opportunities of diverse and varying needs. And to match that, Hashem has created different characteristics in the people who have the ability to fill those gaps. And there is a matchup that happens. There are people who prefer to do one sort of charity, people who prefer to do another, and that's the way the world has been working, the philanthropic world has been working forever. To a great degree, that halacha gives us that leeway, gives us that right to make those choices and to go follow, so to speak, the inner voice of what, which charities, which which tzedakahs we would like to invest in ourselves. The perspective of the Torah as far as money's earned is 80%, 90% of our profits belong to us. We can do what we want with it. 10 to 20% are really not ours. The concept of tithing, which is 10 to 20%, it's really not ours in the first place. But we are gifted with the ability of toivas hanoh, the ability to be the decider of where we're going to invest those monies. So the perspective is a little bit different. It's not that I'm parting with my money. I've been given the ability to be a steward and on that money, and the ability to decide where I'm going to give that money. And let's take a look at source number one. This is from the Tur, one of the earliest halachic codifiers. For you must know that the money is, you'll forgive me, I my bifocals broke. No, it's okay. I have to see you too, right? So you'll forgive me. My arms aren't long enough, but we're going to work this through. Okay. I went to a wedding, and on the day of the wedding in New York, I got into the rental car, and my temple broke. So I quickly went to a glasses store, and I bought a new pair of single vision. So
we could also read for you.
Oh, that's a good idea. Okay. For he must know that the money is not his, but it is on deposit to perform the will of the depositor. That means Hashem. And his will, that he distributes the poor from it. Okay, so we turned it around. The tzedakah money is in my possession as a safekeeping. I have the right to decide where I'm gonna give it. Having said that, there are some guideposts that the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, delineates for us. And one of the more famous ones, and we've talked about this, and you've written about this, is the Rambam's ladder, Maimonides' ladder of the priorities, and the levels of giving. And that's source number two, where we're going to talk about giving somebody a job. There are 8 levels of tzedakah. The highest level is when one strengthens a downtrodden Jew and gives him a gift, a loan, or includes him in a partnership, or gives him a job, in order to strengthen his hand, allowing him not to be dependent on the gifts of others. So, so we see from this piece in Shulchan Aruch, which is again from the Maimonides, we see that it's so important to be able to protect the dignity of the one who's receiving the charity. If the person has a choice to take a handout, which are earn it himself, the dignity of that person would be so much in a better state if we'd be able to give him a job, or a loan, or a gift that's not a tzedakah, a gift between friends. We see here in this halacha, we see the idea of the highest level of tzedakah would be somewhat what we would say. Rather than jumping in the river, going to the top of the river and preventing the cause in the first place. To give somebody a job is systemic. To create a program, to train people into crafts or professions that will give them an ability to sustain themselves. That is the greatest level of tzedakah. It's a systemic approach rather than an emergency approach. And this is a very important a value that a systemic looking what created the problem in the first place. We see from this piece of Shulchan Aruch that has additional values of saving the dignity of the people in the first place and avoiding the emergency altogether. Go ahead.
Just one quick introduction or interruption. The old adage, you know, give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man a fish, he eats for a lifetime. And that's exactly what we're talking about. If you teach somebody, if you give them the skills, if you train them, if you give them a loan to build their own business, then they sustain themselves, and they're no longer dependent upon you for charity.
And if you look at...
Yeah. But the problem is, he needs a fish today.
Right.
Right? He's hungry today. Those drowning people needed to be rescued now.
So if you look at the global tzedakah needs, if we look at a long-term systemic viewpoint, look from that viewpoint, we're going to make things. We're going to lower the poverty and our collective emergencies, and tzedakahs will go a much further way. So it's absolutely the strategy to follow. But the man needs the fish today. And if we were to ignore the fact that the need for the fish today, that would be really misguided as well, right? We send a guy to school and we'll pay for his school for 3 years. He needs to support his family for those 3 years. We would be misguided if we would ignore that. And that's at source number 3. You shall open your hand to him. You shall lend him his requirement, whatever's lacking to him. Tzedakah, as Rashi explains, a handout, or if he doesn't want that, you give him a loan. A way to sustain him for his immediate needs this verse in Deuteronomy in Devarim talks about whatever he's lacking. We need to take care of those gaps in the poor person's life right now as well. So back to the question over here. We have the luxury today of thinking in its systemic, long-term approach. We have that more of an ability to look at that in a time of prosperity. And relatively speaking, I know we're still in a recovery, but relatively speaking, in world history, we're in a time of great abundance, and we have that luxury to be able to think long-term and make the plans to avoid the problems in the long term. But we need to balance that. So what's the balance? So it's important to know that. We've given a class here years ago about the pecking order of tzedakahs. I did it actually with Doug Sesserman. And it was the idea about, the concentric circles and the priorities, who we give first and who we give second and third. And why it's important to note that most halachic authorities view that not as we give A and not B, B and not C, etc. It's more about prioritizing how we split up the pie. We would not want to say we do this and not that. You know, when you want to diversify your investment, you want to do the right thing in many ways. So it's about how you split up the pie when we talk about prioritizing tzedakah. So here as well, we have this dilemma. We should not be looking at it as one way or the other. It should be more, which move the dilemma over to what percentage. How do we split up the pie? And ultimately, it will be allowed for the person who is shepherding and the shomer, the watching over God's gift, of that 10 to 20%. It's his ability to make that decision. But I'd share with you a piece from the Chafetz Chaim, lived about 100 years ago, died in 1933, and he was known for many, many things, played a very important part of European Jewry during those turbulent times. And he wrote a book on tzedakah, Avas Chesed. And he about actually to be more accurate about kindness, about chesed, and part of kindness, bestowing kindness and doing good with others. Part of that is doing it with your money. So in the section he talks about tzedakah, he advises, and this isn't a hard fast halachic ruling, because every situation will have different things pulling it. But he gives the following formula, which I thought I would be relevant to share. He says, he's talking about the balance over there between outright tzedakah and something which he encourages very much, which is free loan society. And he talks about setting up a system where you're able to lend somebody money and in a dignified way, yet in a way that you have a system that you'll get the money back in a dignified way. And he talks of setting up throughout the shtetlach, you know, the shtetls in Europe, to set out every city should have one of these free loan society, institutions. And so he encourages very, very much this concept. In addition to that, he talks about the concept of giving people jobs, setting up systems to set up jobs. And what he writes over there is his formula is, he says, 1/3 to the long term, 1/3 to the free loan systems and the job systems, and 2/3 to direct tzedakah to the needy. That is the formula. So again, it's not going to be hard fast. This is a suggestion, and the argument could be made that in these times things perhaps are different. We may have an ability to change that. That dynamic, but I think the perspective that we need to look at this is that it's a question of cutting up the pie, splitting up according to a certain formula, and valuing both, not ignoring either one of these, and a formula would be a 2/3, 1/3. That's a possibility. So that's it on this piece here.
So I'll use this to tell another story, and that is, do you remember when the Boulder floods happened about 3 years ago and Lyons got washed out and it was a 1,000-year flood? Well, you'll recall that here in Denver it rained cats and dogs for days, but we didn't have the flooding. And I was walking down Larimer Street with a colleague, and we each had umbrellas. And we were going to breakfast, to snooze on the corner of Park and Larimer. And we were walking down the street. It was pouring like heck. It couldn't have been a worse rainstorm. And all of a sudden, a man stepped out from behind a building and stopped us. And we looked at him, and he was drenched from head to toe. And he was obviously homeless. He obviously disabled, obviously desperate. And he looked at us, and he said, "May I have your umbrella?" And I was carrying my prized ADL umbrella, one that was a gift to me for something that I'd done for ADL. And as my hand began to tighten, in the second that I began to grab my umbrella a little snugger, my colleague went, "Here," and handed this man her umbrella and joined me under mine. Before I could even decide what to do, her instinct was to hand. And so we walked together into the restaurant, and we looked out the front glass window, and we see this man, now in a wheelchair, scooting himself down Larimer Street with his feet, holding an umbrella, her umbrella, over his head, shelter from the storm. Another instantaneous decision that one has to make. I've given you two where I didn't make the most generous decision, right? But I'm human, right? People are human, and we've got to... Pardon?
Just a slow learner.
I'm a slow learner, apparently. But no, but the idea, the question there is, what is our duty to take care of ourselves so that we can help others? What is our duty to sacrifice our own well-being in order to protect others? It's another version of the turkey story, but it happened to me here decades later.
So Bruce told me these stories last week or a week and a half ago, and I found them very soul, you know, to be very need a lot of soul searching. And I have this thing I do at our Friday night Shabbos table with our family, that I throw out moral dilemmas, and I don't give the answer. I don't give my opinion. I just let the guests and the kids fight it out and figure it out, and you see personalities coming out. And so I actually did both these questions here. So they're very, very, you know, great soul-searching questions.
All right, so the next question, and by the way, I once took a job test and early in my career, and one of the highest jobs I should have gone for was to be a rabbi, so that I could wrestle with these moral questions every day. But I didn't.
Bruce, never too late.
Okay. So the next question is the decision about giving anonymously or getting recognition and credit for your generosity. We deal with this on a practical level all the time with clients, because some I even deal with couples where the husband wants his name on a building and the wife wants to give anonymous. That this stuff happens all the time, and so Rabbi, you'll lead us in a discussion about what
the last question, I got out of it without giving a clear definitive answer. I'm going to give some more of a definitive answer this time. Okay. So let's take a look at source number 4. This, again, is from Maimonides. It's codified in the Code of Jewish Law. And he's talking about the next level. The next level is when one gives a gift to a poor person but doesn't know who the recipient is. And the poor person doesn't know who the benefactor is. So that's double
anonymity.
Anonymity. Thank you. Anonymous on both sides. Okay? So that, again, is a tremendous sensitivity to the self-esteem of the recipient. He doesn't have to feel like he took a handout from anybody. And not only that, the giver doesn't even know who it is. So it protects the self-respect and the dignity. So that's the next level. And you take a look at source number 5. The next level, one notch down, is when the donor knows who the recipient is, but the recipient doesn't know from who he received it. So, again, the concept of giving anonymous is a very lofty way of giving tzedakah. It's clear in Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. It's clear from other sources as well. Parenthetically, this would giving without knowing who it is. Again, a benefactor giving to an individual without knowing who the individual is, that takes on a new dynamic if you're giving through an organization. Because it wouldn't apply to when you know who the organization is, that's not lowering the self-dignity of the organization. That's what the organization does. They go out and distribute the goodwill or the tzedakah or the whatever, to the finances through that. So if we're talking about giving anonymously to an individual, we see clearly that it's a much better way to give. If we're talking about giving anonymously to an organization, then it doesn't necessarily take on that same level of tzedakah. However, there's another thing to keep in mind is, when your clients are coming to you and they're saying, in your example, the wife would say, let's give this quietly, okay? What she's perhaps saying, echoing, is a very deep Jewish value of humility and being careful not to become arrogant with the gifts that God gave. Let's take a look at source number 6. Walk humbly with your God. Mitzvahs that are done privately are on a purer level. This is a very deep Jewish value. And take a look at source number 7. We don't want to come to arrogance. We've been given a gift by Hashem to be able to distribute, to be on the giving end. We need to remember that that's a gift, and we don't want to become haughty. But source number 7 is from Proverbs. An abomination of Hashem are all arrogant people. Arrogance is something which is not a Jewish value. We need to avoid that. So we should run far away from haughtiness and arrogance. And that would be much easier if we follow the woman that you consulted with and say that, let's keep this quiet. Let's do this in a humble and a more lofty way. So the case for giving privately, even to an organization, is a strong one to be made. However, go ahead.
I was just going to say, how raise money for an organization, there is something also that is really very valued by somebody who is willing to step up and attach their name to their gift as a model for the rest of the community.
Exactly. And that's where we're going next. And you know this already.
And even Rambam acknowledged that role of the donor, right? He even said,
We're going to bring from the Rashba in a minute some very strong statement.
From the Kohanim.
From what?
Kohanim.
In the temple. And that's, I don't have to give this class anymore. Okay. Let's, okay. Let's eat. Okay. So let's take in consideration another factor here. Would I give more money if it would be publicized? That's a different aspect we have to look at. Or look at it in a different way. Will the poor, the tzedakah, the organization, the need, the cause, be able to collect more money if the names are publicized? Let's just turn that, spin that around. That's a very important consideration. One second here. Yeah, so we'll go in this order. Yeah. Take a look at source number 8. A person should always busy himself with Torah study and observance of mitzvahs for the altruistic sake, and even not for the altruistic sake, because doing them not for the altruistic sake will bring you to do them for the altruistic sake. Let me say that in our words, okay? A person should always endeavor to do Torah and mitzvahs, even if they're not for the best cause, even if it's for a little honor, a little pleasure, a tax receipt, or whatever benefit you're going to get out of it. Do it. You know why? And this is the end of that piece of the Talmud and Nazir. Because if you keep on doing mitzvahs, even not for the greatest, most altruistic reason, you know what? You will get accustomed to doing good things, and eventually you will do them for the altruistic reason. Because after a while, you're used to, you know, giving your tzedakah. Here we're talking about tzedakah. You give your tzedakah and you get your acknowledgement and you get your honor for it and you like it. Year after year after year, eventually you say, you know what? I value that tzedakah. I give every year. I give that charity, and you know what? I've learned that this is something to value. This is a good cause, and you're going to be giving for a more altruistic reason. You're training yourself. And this is an important concept in the Torah, that we need to harness all of our natural tendencies and impulses and things that we like for our own benefit. We need to harness them for a higher cause. And so it's not bad. It's not bad to want to, it's not the highest level to give money for the great fame that I'm going to get. But that's what the fame is there for. The fame is, get the fame out of doing something good. Harness that. Go ahead.
Do we not want to inspire our children and grandchildren when they see we're doing this? We're keeping it so quiet, nobody knows. But if they see, Grandpa did this, maybe we should look at that also. But this, you know, something is coming out of that. It's growing. There's more to it.
Absolutely.
And there are two sides to that coin as well. Absolutely, we work with families who want to pass those values on to their children and grandchildren, and even grandchildren they'll never meet, right? But then the other side of the coin is that I work with families of wealth where the children and grandchildren are embarrassed by their parents' wealth and public display of wealth. So I have to work with them. I'm in the process right now of changing a foundation's name from the family name to an independent name having nothing to do with the family, so that the children and grandchildren will be more willing to participate because they're embarrassed by their privilege and their wealth. So that's a delicate balance, and we find ourselves in the middle of that. But I tend to prefer your version of passing values and walking the walk and setting an example, but it has another side to it in families of wealth.
And that is source number 9, what you just said, source number 9. Rabbi Lezer said, greater is he who causes others to act than he who acts himself. Right? Because we are limited to what we are able to do. And in this context, we're talking about tzedakah. So we can give a finite amount of money. But the example that we set for our children, for our families, and for others, like if somebody, you know, sees that I donate, a mezuzah, a classroom, they say, wow, he did that? I could do more. So we can make that ripple effect.
Yeah, so I want to ask a question. How many of you have gotten an annual report from an organization that you support, and you look at the list to make sure you're on it? Everybody? No. And you look on the list to make sure that they recognized you for your gift, right? Most of us do that, right? How many of you then also look at the higher levels to see who has given more, to see whether or not you want to be like them in any way that might inspire you to give more? That's the role of recognition. It is a little bit of keeping up with the Joneses.
In a good way, for good stuff.
In a good way, for good stuff. Exactly.
So this is a little bit off topic, but so about the anonymous thing. If you're wanting to make contributions in memory of someone, even if you don't want to be recognized, does it help elevate their soul or anything?
Great
question.
If
you know you're doing it, then God knows you're doing it, but what about recognizing that person?
So is your question specifically about publicizing that person's name in memory of?
Yes.
And publicizing your name attached to that.
Or even if you don't want your name.
Yeah, so our Jewish tradition has a very strong belief in this concept of doing mitzvahs to benefit a departed soul. And it's part of our definite culture. And we understand that something metaphysical happens when we do something on behalf of that soul. And giving tzedakah is one of those things that we do all the time. Now, the question is about publicizing in the context of our conversation here. Publicizing it in the memory of that, I don't know the metaphysical side, what happens, up there so much, but I would wonder, is it so important to write that name for the metaphysical side, if we're dissecting this question? Or is it just a nice way to honor that person, and which is a good thing?
It also helps other people to remember that person, perhaps they do.
Indeed. That's what Jerry also
does. Right, and then it brings us back to our thing of encouraging others to do things in the memory of their loved ones. I'm just going to finish this piece off from the Rajba, because the Rajba says this in a very definite way. We're just talking about the different sides, but he actually comes out in a very definite way. What do we do when you have a balance? The value of giving in an anonymous way, in a more altruistic way, versus the idea of encouraging others. Which one wins out? And he says that the Rajba is a medieval scholar who lived in Spain, in Barcelona. He died in 1310. He writes as follows. He says, from the story of the Talmud in Bava Basra, we're going to talk about it, you learn that the sextons in the temple would inscribe the names of the donors in order that the donors have a good memorial for mitzvahs and to open the door for more mitzvah doers. So we pull apart those words over here, and we're going to understand what's going on. The Talmud in Bava Basra, 133b, says that when Yossi ben Yoezer donated, and this was somebody who was referring to that, donated to the temple, that they inscribed on those items the donor. And this custom goes back way, and the Talmud is bringing in a way condoning this practice. The Rajba says that this is, for other sources as well, he says this is the right way to go for two reasons. Number one, it is leaving a good legacy, which is an interesting concept, which you touched upon, but it's an interesting concept, not so much our discussion today, but there is this concept of leaving a good legacy, and to encourage, and the second thing is to encourage others to do the same. So when it push comes to shove, when it's one against the other, the Rajba tells us that it's a good thing to do, to put your name on it, and sometimes it's difficult to do, And he's saying if you have a choice, all things considered, and there's other factors that come in, and it's not a rule that must happen every single time we give tzedakah, obviously. But as if we have a dilemma, putting our name on a building or not, the fact that we are teaching others, inspiring others, be it from our family or just bystanders, that weighs in heavier than anything else. And the Rashba is telling us that that's the way to go. Yep.
So I have a woman that I work with who lives in the mountains, and she's a Jewish woman, not married, no kids, and she has a lot of money. And we give away a ton of money every year. But she does it through a vehicle called a donor advised fund. And the name of the donor advised fund is the Green Waves Fund. And you'll look around town and you'll see the Green Waves Fund supports this and supports that. Nobody but me and the IRS know who she is. And she gives completely anonymously, and she has enormous joy in that. And she doesn't get caught up in the rigmarole of having to go to dinners and having to do this and having to be recognized. All she does is give money away. Her grandfather was a rabbi, and she's a lovely woman, and I get to work with her every fall, and it's the Green Waves Fund. And literally nobody but me and the IRS and the Donor Advice Fund has any idea who she is. It's joyful to work for her because there's no ego. There's no ego. There's benefits, there's costs. None of these questions are black and white. I just gave you that example because...
How could she influence her friends to do what she does?
Nope.
She doesn't choose to.
But when she gives a $25,000 matching grant,
right,
to an organization, the Green Waves Fund will match your gift. Right. Then so she's inspiring others without it being about who she is.
And this dynamic works, you know, when we move over to the next generation of legacies.
Can you help her make her decisions?
Yeah, I do the research and I help her find the causes.
Rabbi, here's your first.
Okay. Joe, you get 5% of that.
I don't want it. But listen, here's the Green Wave. Let's start looking next year. Beis Yaakov will work with the Green Wave.
Sounds good.
I'm going to play devil advocate. By you revealing the name of the fan, aren't you kind of cross doing her wish by you revealing the name of the fan?
Green Waves Fund? What does that mean to you? It means nothing.
Not to me. Maybe it means to her.
No, she's happy. She's happy that people...
If she's sitting here, would she mind?
That I... If she, maybe she is sitting here.
What?
Maybe she's seated right next to you.
Okay.
I don't know.
Would she mind?
No. No, because it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
It could be called the Glass of Water Fund. It doesn't matter what it's called. It's completely anonymous.
Okay. Completely, I don't know. I argue that.
When we were talking about this, Bruce asked me an interesting question about the joy of the. Do you want to get to that?
What about the joy of the what?
The joy of the gift. Is that take away from your?
Am I following?
Okay, so I'll just say, yeah. Bruce posed an interesting question, which is not here on in our notes and not. Yeah, we didn't get to that, but just related to this.
We got two more questions.
Two more, yeah. Just related to this, Bruce pointed out that a pure altruistic giving probably doesn't exist.
I know.
Go ahead.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
So there's a lady near my office. I work near City Park, and she sits there. She's homeless, and she sits there every day. And she's sick, and she's old, and she's weak. And frequently I'll leave a luncheon like this, and I'll pack a lunch for her. And as I go back to the office, I'll roll down the window and I'll hand her a lunch, right? And she looks at me, even though I've done it dozens of times, she has no idea. She's never seen me before. That's not in her mental scope to even recognize me. So there's no recognition. I'm not a hero to her in anything. She's delighted because she goes, oh, I have a meal. And she literally takes it and starts eating right away because she's hungry, right? I roll up the window and I drive off and I feel like $1 million. I feel great. I feel like, wow, what a righteous man I am. What a good person. I'm walking the walk. I care so much that I would give her a meal, right? She doesn't even know who I am, right? So is that altruistic or do I do it because it makes me feel good? Those are questions that people get to ask.
Well,
I think that's an excellent question. I've been thinking about this. And you know, maybe there are some lofty levels of somebody, you know, doing something without any attachment to. But I think what we need to focus on is we should look at this as, in Hebrew we would call it simcha shel mitzvah, the happiness of doing a mitzvah. That enhances the mitzvah. A mitzvah is enhanced when we do it in a happy way, when we enjoy doing a mitzvah. And applies to any mitzvah, and even to this. So I would say that it doesn't take away from the altruistic, you know, for us here now. It's great.
It's actually been studied by psychologists, and it's called the helper's high, or the giver's glow. And they've even taken two groups of people and showed them two different movies: one of Mother Teresa and one of something else. And the blood levels of certain chemicals of the Mother Teresa, they feel better, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And if you can tap into that, you've actually accomplished something. If you recognize it, then you find the joy in being charitable. All right, next question.
I have a comment on that. I think that if we test our pulse on our giving, we tend to give to things that will make us much better and feel better. It's much harder to walk by that homeless person and not do something. And when you do something, you kind of satisfy your need or desire. I think a better test sometimes is to give a gift or give donations when it challenges you more. There's a very sad fact that there's a lot of abusive people who are very big community activists, right? They'll help everyone, then they come home, and the person the closest to is the hardest, right, to be nice to and everything. So I think there is a little bit of that kind of, feel good attitude. This is how I answer up my, did my good deed for the day. That is self-serving.
So
I don't think it's only self-serving. I think you have a true altruistic thing when it challenges you seriously.
That brings us to the next
is
point.
When you get. Mm-hmm.
That goes right into the next point. Greenwashing.
The next question is what if a charity that you're supporting is receiving donations from an organization or a person or a company that has earned that money in unethical ways, in illegal ways, in immoral ways? What does that do to you as a fellow donor to that organization? Do you have an obligation to say to that nonprofit organization, whatever it might be, I don't like the fact that you're accepting this dirty money? Because people have died because of that money, or people are sick because of that money, or you can, the list is long. So I that's the question. And before we go, I write this monthly column, and I send out a monthly newsletter by email. Some of you already get it. I'm just going to send out a sign up sheet. If you'd like to receive a once a month email from me with all these kind of questions, which I write about and think about on a regular basis, I'd be honored to have you. And if not, that's fine. So I'm going to, just because time and people are leaving, I just want to give people a chance to sign up.
Can you answer that question?
Yeah. Okay, so let me address that question. So I think we need to dissect this and pull it back together, okay? We're going to pull it, take it apart piece by piece, and then we're going to put it back together. So the first thing we have to talk about is from the perspective of the organization that's receiving the quote-unquote dirty money, okay? Can an organization take money that is unethically earned? Now, for purposes of this session, we're not going to give any examples of what that would be, but just in your own mind, something which is clearly unethically earned money. Okay, we don't need to debate what that is right now. So, can that organization take it? So, I think that if we talk in broad terms, we're all in trouble. Okay, because what person has earned money that has never done anything wrong, never insulted anybody, never spoken not nicely about somebody. So we're not talking about that, right? We're not saying that by association, taking money from somebody who's done some not nice thing, it would be unethical to take that money. So what is the question? The question would be more two possible questions. One is this money directly connectable towards, can I source this money back to that moral wrongdoing? That will be the question number one. Question number two is, even if I can't connect them, am I condoning the wrongdoing by accepting that money?
And does money have a character? Does money acquire a character by virtue of being earned immorally, illegally, or unethically?
Right. So there is this concept. Let's go back to the question of connecting that money. So first of all, it's important it's important for us to look at, Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about this. He says, a person has numerous streams of income. One of them, two of them, are morally unacceptable. But he's got other streams of income. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that in that case, where it's not directly connected to the wrongdoing, it is halakhically permissible to take money from that person because it can, and we can assume that it's coming from the proper source. Now you think about this. Again, if it's directly coming from the non-proper source, then we have a problem here called mitzvah habo ba'avera, a mitzvah that is coming through a wrongdoing. There's a whole concept of this in the Talmud. But in most situations, there are numerous streams to that person's income, and a person would be allowed to take money from that individual and say it's coming from here. Let's turn this around. When I give tzedakah to an organization, I strongly like one program, I strongly disapprove of another program. I can, both on a practical level and a metaphysical level, I can give them money to go to the places I want. So we turn this back around. When I'm taking money, I have the right to take money from that entity, and as long as there are streams that it can come from. However, we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility, especially as Jewish organizations, to make sure that we're not making a chilul Hashem. That would mean a desecration of God's name. If I would be condoning the actions of a donor because if it would be perceived that way, that I'm condoning that donor, then I'd have to think long and hard about that. And that's source number 11. And that is from Masilas Yesharim. We're running out of time, so I'll just tell you what it says. We need to be super careful not to give the impression that we're making a chilul Hashem, desecrating God's name. And as a Jewish organization, we need to be extra careful not to condone something wrong. Now, as far as greenwashing is concerned, which is that an organization says, I did this wrongdoing, but now I'm going to whitewash it, to greenwash it with my good activities.
Money selling heroin, a good example. Making money selling heroin. Everybody would agree that's evil, immoral, illegal, right? Then you turn that around and give that away. Do you greenwash that money?
Right, so greenwashing that money. So I think we need to make a distinction, a very important distinction between, an example that we were throwing around was, British Petroleum, messed up the Gulf for the next 100 years. And then they go, and I don't know if this is true or not, but just for example. And then they go up and they make botanical gardens around the world. Okay, so now here's the question. Do we take that money? Does Denver City Botanical Gardens take that money or not, right? So that's green. That would be a greenwashing thing. So here's an important question. Did they do teshuvah? Are they in the corrective side? Are they trying to make good? Did they stop doing the bad that they did? Then we have an important concept of allowing somebody to do teshuvah and not being... And those are the sources here, but we're running out of time. We need to, if somebody asks you forgiveness, allow them. Don't be hard about it. Don't be difficult. And just the other side of it is, but if they continue to do the wrong while they're doing it, you know what they're doing? That's just like window dressing. That's just whitewashing.
Greenwashing.
And that would not be a good thing.
It's very difficult to judge men. Now, he used the subject matter, the heroin. Now, if somebody in New York donates money to the yeshiva from his marijuana profits, that would be terrible. But if somebody in Colorado donates money to you for his marijuana sales, it's fine.
And that's why I probably said we should not...
Difficult line to walk.
It's not difficult, because what's legal is legal, and what's illegal is illegal. Yeah.
And that's why I...
Yeah, the legal side of it is easy.
In Vegas, the law is illegal.
What'd you say?
In Vegas, the law.
I think we're officially over. Those, it's 1:15, so those,
okay,
those want to continue can...
The one question.
Oh, yeah.
Never, ever, ever, ever donate over the phone or at the front door unless you personally know the individual and you can ask them, what percentage are you taking? Studies have been done that sometimes up to 95% of telephone and front door solicitations go to the solicitor. If you care about the cause, go online and donate directly to the organization. Never give at the front door or to the phone. No matter how cute the young person is or how charming they might be, they are being paid, and a high percentage of your donation is not going to the cause that you care about. That's a little practical tip from the Dubosky Group.
Except don't you have today in Denver somebody that gives a certificate to somebody?